Well, today's sermon is scheduled to be talking about what are the odds. I didn't check this morning to see what the odds were. As we gather today on the biggest betting and wagering day in the nation, the largest consumption of beer, the largest gathering of people watching television, it's a remarkable day in American secular religion. And I am speaking, of course, about the Super Bowl. And I'll segue around the issue of odds in a moment. But the Super Bowl answers a couple of fundamental questions, particularly for Unitarian Universalists. One, do you have to have a God in order to have a religion? No. The Super Bowl is proof that you don't need a divinity. You might still pray out there somewhere, but you don't need a divinity in order to participate in all of the panoply and passion of the Super Bowl. The other question that it answers for Unitarian Universalism is, well, if you don't have a religion, will you still have anger and violence and hatred and irrationality? And the answer is yes. The Super Bowl does, and this day with all of its rituals, does what religions do. Organizes people into us and them, the good guys and the bad guys, and it's almost completely arbitrary, with the exception of the Raiders. And some people do it the kind of normal religious way, and that is, well, you know, I'm from New York, and my team is, and it will always be my team. I'm from San Francisco, and I'm a 49er guy, and that's the way it is. But just like American religion, there are people who also change affiliation. They move to another town and adopt another faith and or another football team. It has everything that religion has. It has ritual. It has communion. Communion, of course, is beer for the wine and guacamole for the host. It's very kind of an American take on religiosity. And it is this titanic struggle of good and evil and what are the odds. Right now, you have to say that the Cardinals are the good guys and the Steelers are the bad guys, and the odds, as usual, favor the bad guys. But, of course, if that's your team, they can be the good guys, too, because we're Unitarians, and we really don't believe that those labels stick. But some people do. You know, they take this stuff as seriously as Orthodox take religion, which sometimes just misses the point of having fun. Some people just grab onto a team or a sport or an idea, and it becomes extensions of their own sense of self, extensions of their own insecurity, their own weakness, a projection of their fears and their fantasies and their aggression. And of course, it is filled with prayer. People are praying and shouting and screaming at the television set as if their shouts went through the television set, got to the coaches, got to the players, and actually made a difference. You draw your own conclusions about my theology of prayer from that. But I do it too. The same way I scream out the questions on Jeopardy. I don't have to believe in it in order to do it, which makes me irrational, therefore human. It's a big wagering day, and the truth is, we don't know who's going to win. I don't think even the referees know, but they might. The odds don't really make that much difference. They just give people a kind of stake in the outcome, and an artificial stake in what is truly an artificial outcome. The question of what the odds are in anything in life is to me, and I hope to you, an interesting question. 2 weeks ago, I talked about what those long odds were a couple of thousand years ago that anybody would remember an obscure carpenter from the corner of the Roman Empire who never wrote a book and never raised an army and never conquered a land. The odds were infinitesimal. And what were the odds that his tribe, Judaism, would be remembered and we'd be meeting in their building? What were the odds when Rosa Parks sat down that others would stand up and against the wicked institution of segregation, and that sitting down that made others stand up would make a difference? The odds are virtually incalculable. We don't know what is going to make the difference when people behave and take chances and act out of something that is authentic. Now, philosophers sometimes, I saw you twitch on that, so I'm not saying all philosophers. Philosophers sometimes talk about, listen, there is always pattern, there's always order, there's always what's called necessity. Anything that happens has to have happened. It was logically necessary. If we could go back to the moment of creation, to the Big Bang, from the world of physics or from the moment of creation, from the world of theology, and you trace every domino, everything that happens, if not predetermined, at least becomes logically necessary looking backwards because, well, it happened. You also have people that say, no, that's complete nonsense. Everything is random and chaos. And we just don't know that where the dominoes are going to fall, and we don't know, and anything could happen at any time, and there's just no way of ever knowing anything. There is a third way, and that is to see and understand that occasionally there's order in the chaos. That if I were to somehow take out of my pocket a large cup full of sand and pour it onto the table, it would most likely, in the absence of air conditioning or some other kind of windstorm, fall in something that looks like a pyramid. It probably wouldn't go flat. It probably wouldn't be a double pyramid or a triple pyramid. We can predict certain kinds of patterns when we're using large numbers, but we can't predict the individual. I can pour out the sand 100 times, it will form a pyramid 100 times, but I cannot predict where any individual grain of sand will be. The National Safety Council can look at the traffic fatalities for the weekend of Labor Day and predict how many people will die, but not which ones. And of course, that's the more interesting question for all of us. If it's us, it's 100%. If it's not us, it's also 100%. If it's somebody that we know and love, then those numbers become personalized. But we can't know. As a clergyman, I am in conversations with people all of the time about issues of odds. I just got a cancer diagnosis. What are the odds that I'll survive? What are the odds that I'll be here, that I'll be able to see my children marry, my grandchildren born? What are the odds? And the answer is always whatever number the doctors and the statisticians come up with, it really comes to 100% one way or another. We don't know. We play them. We act as if, and with some good reason, we try to increase our odds, but there is no certainty even in odds. I have been involved in conversations where people were given what you had to assume were death sentences, and somebody forgot to carry them out. My dear, dear friend who has had twice metastasized melanomas 10 years ago is today fine, very much against the odds. Other times tragedy has come where it shouldn't have happened according to the odds. But he was healthy. Well, yes, and now we'll carry the coffin to the grave. You do what you can to change the odds, but life is still this problem of we know the patterns that the sands will fall, but we don't know the fate of any individual grain of sand. It is Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty. You know how the molecules will be dispersed, but not the individual molecules. And yet, for all of that uncertainty, we play the odds, and we should play the odds. Somebody had to refuse to sit in the back of the bus, and how many people did that encourage for others to stand up? It was against the odds, but it was important that somebody do the right thing. Every time we choose what we believe, and I'll get to that choosing and that believing, is the right thing, we increase the odds of our values and of our vision being carried out in the world. Am I going to succeed? I don't know. Are my ideas and my politics, are they going to triumph someday? I don't know. I know that if I don't try to live them, I know if I don't make an effort, that they won't. At least I won't be a part of that process. I will be left out of that little pile of sand, those molecules dispersed within a vacuum. That engagement and passion and caring and effort do not guarantee success. But sloth and depression and cynicism guarantee that somebody else will make that future, that somebody else will create tomorrow, and you have to ask yourself, gee, do I think they're going to be better at it than I am or worse at it than I am? Do I want my life possibly to make a difference in the world? No certainty, no guarantee if you do, but pretty much certainty and pretty much guarantee if you don't. But human beings are interesting. We're complex. We don't always do that completely rational calculation, even of the odds. Again, one of my occupational hazards is occasionally people will make appointments to talk to me about, religion. And what I have found is that there are people who are very resistant to good theology. That there are people who the idea of chaos, the idea that nobody is in control, that fates are not written by an all-wise, usually all-white and all-male, old guy on a golden throne that didn't get the memo about wearing a suit instead of a toga, that the idea that that person is not controlling everything is just scary. And so there are people who would rather have a God who is angry and jealous and judgmental and loves you to death but will burn you for eternity if you don't do it exactly right, than the idea that we've got something to do with what happens here in this world today and tomorrow and in the future. Whatever is divine, whatever you informs your soul and your spirit and charges you up, whatever that ineffable presence may be, what we choose and what we do gives us a chance to make this place better, to make each other's lives better. And maybe the terrible frustration is that for most of us, we never know what the difference was. We never know whether it was something that we said or did, a smile we gave, a meeting we went to, whether it was going to a demonstration and carrying a picket sign or signing a petition, being involved in a political process, hugging somebody that felt sad, smiling at somebody that you don't know in the street, starting a conversation with a person who looks old or young and alone and creating that moment of contact, if that made some difference, a good difference, maybe a bad difference, maybe all the difference in the world to that person that day. And we don't know. So what we're stuck with is, got to do something. You know, can't just hide out, can't just refuse to act, can't just refuse to smile or care or be attached to each other and the future, and we don't know how it will turn out. We don't know, our lives, pebbles thrown in a still pond, what the ripples will be. We don't know whether it's direct, something that somebody says to us, a telephone call that is made or not made, and the difference that it makes in somebody's life, a decisive difference in somebody's life. I didn't know I was going to talk about this. Danzig calls me up one day, about 34 years ago. When I was 10. My son was just 37 this week. So it was about 35 years ago. He calls me up and says, you know, we got this church down in Southern California. Would you be interested in, they didn't call it auditioning, but that's what they meant. And so I moved to Southern California. Then Jack Thiebert, who was not here today, gives me a call and says, you know, we have this church out here in Fullerton. Would you want to come out here and talk to us? A couple of phone calls change lives and destiny. Times when you are feeling down and somebody says, you know, I really appreciate you. I really like you. It can change the universe. You can't count on every call and every smile and every honk of the horn or every gesture with all the fingers of your hands to somebody changing the universe, but you know, it can. It can. The power that we have to make a difference in each other's lives, directly and indirectly. There are so many things that I do that I learned because there were people in my lives who were role models, sometimes modeling what I should do and sometimes modeling what I shouldn't do. But they made a difference, even when they weren't thinking of it. I remember very clearly one of my congregants, Bonnie Foreman's son was at Harvard, and I was going back to Boston to the headquarters of the Unitarian Universalist Association for a conference on helping congregations grow, and I looked him up and I took him out to dinner. And I realized only afterwards that I had done that because my closest friend in high school's father called me my freshman year when I was out of the city that I lived in and invited me out to dinner. So that Jack Drucker's invitation to me gets extended into an invitation to somebody else. There are all of these people who make all of these small and sometimes great pieces of influence in our lives and touch our hearts as we go on and out and touch others. It is the ultimate experience of religion, of the sense of being bound up together, that we do not live lives in isolation, whether we belong to a religious organization or a secular organization. Being together with people, being nourished and feeling the responsibility to give nourishment back is the prime social contract that can infuse our hearts with joy and our lives with meaning. And it is the great challenge in life is to be involved, to be involved so that even though we don't know the results of our decisions, we don't know the results of our actions, we don't know the results ultimately of our passions, what we can do is to know by having examined lives what our values are. And acting out of a sense of authenticity, make those values into actions with real people. But here comes the hardest part. To have both passion and to have commitment, but also to do it with humility. Because you cannot know the results, you cannot know for certain that you are right, and you must not look at those with other passions and say, and they are completely wrong and they are completely evil. 2 weeks ago, I spoke a little bit about the amount of hate mail that I get for the columns that I write, only occasionally for sermons, but more for columns. And the nice thing is, if anything happens here, it's usually with good grammar. When I get the hate mail for columns, whether from the Fullerton Observer or from Daily News, there's usually an inverse relationship between somebody's personal animus and their spelling ability. It must be very frustrating for the people, you know, who trying to email me with crayon, but that's another story. They haven't quite worked out the technology on that yet, though there is some handwriting recognition software that may make that possible. Actually, it is possible now. But I answer all hate mail. And I answer all hate mail with something that I more or less believe, much more than less. And that is, my adversary in the world is not the person who disagrees with me. It's not the person who disagrees with me even passionately. It's not the person that thinks, Dobrindt, you're all wet, that was the silliest column I ever read. Because the person that wrote that read it and thought about it, came to a different conclusion, and cared. And I always write back, we don't agree, but my adversary is the person who doesn't care. It's the person who thinks that the game is fixed and that their lives and that their choices don't make any difference. My faith, my deep faith, what gets me out of bed in the morning is the idea that what I choose to do, what I choose to back away from, what I choose to give in terms of emotional generosity or fiscal generosity makes some good difference in the world. My message to you today is, whatever the odds are, they are 100% against you if you don't play. When we engage, we give ourselves, our lives, our suffering, our joy, and most importantly, the world, a chance to be a better place.